Eat local first? Well, according to a study published by UC Merced, up to 90% of Americans could be fed entirely by food grown or raised within 100 miles of their city. This thought leads us to ask, how can local food feed the 90%?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1046th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Nagasaki who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's a pleasure.
Now, Jason, do you think it's possible to survive on food that's grown within 100 miles of this city?
I would certainly hope so, but at the same time, I don't know if we're really set up for that around the whole country right now. Maybe here.
Oh,
where
good.
We
some
are.
Skepticism, huh?
A little
good.
Skeptical, yeah.
All right. All right. Let's go to our intern producer, Dylan Hunsinger, and we'll ask Dylan the same question. Dylan, what do you think? Do you think it possible to survive on the food that we grow around here? Can you make it all on the food, local food?
You know, I think I got to agree with Jason. Here in Santa Cruz, I'm pretty sure we could do it because of the way that our city's set up. Although I am a little skeptical about other places in the country. Then again, I haven't seen the whole country.
Well,
so
good.
Really don't know.
There you go. So here you go, folks. In the early 1970s, way back in the early 70s, there were 6.8 million farms in the United States. So that's like 40 years ago. Then word went out across the land that from USDA's Secretary of Agriculture that farmers should take advantage of the economies of scale made possible by the industrial technologies of the Green Revolution and get big or get out. So farmers industrialized the production of food, which meant fewer and fewer farmers grew more and more of fewer and fewer crops on larger and larger parcels of land. Today, there are less than 2 million farms in the United States. That so few farmers can grow so much food most certainly has its benefits. City people, for example, can now devote more of their precious time to more fruitful endeavors than growing food, like sitting in front of computers, talking on the phone, and taking coffee breaks, right? Still, some city people are not satisfied with eating the processed foods of industrial agriculture. They prefer foods that are fresh, unique, colorful, full of taste, and with a pleasant bouquet. And oh yes, full of nutrition. They want to tell their neighbors about the heritage, dry-farmed, vine-ripened, organic tomatoes they found at the farmer's market. Critics of this local foodism, like our studio engineer and producer, say proponents are just fooling themselves and thinking local food can ever provide enough food to satisfy the hunger of so many people living in such close proximity to each other. Then along comes an academic study claiming up to 90% of Americans could be fed entirely by food grown or raised within 100 miles of their homes. This leads us to ask, how can local food feed the 90%? Well, folks, here to help us study up an answer, we have Dr. Elliot Campbell, who is the Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering at UC Merced and author of the study entitled The Large Potential of Local Croplands to Meet Food Demand in the United States. Dr. Campbell, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you brought a whole studio audience with us, so would you like to introduce them?
Sure. We've got Hazel here. You want to say hi, Hazel?
Hi.
It's my daughter, 7 years old. We've got a 5-year-old, Beatrice, over on the side.
Hello, Beatrice. Can you say hello to the audience?
Hello.
And holding her on her lap is her mama, Liz McDade.
Hi.
There you go, folks. We have the whole Campbell family here to help us out today with this very interesting notion, which is, can we feed ourselves with food grown in or near the city? The large potential of local croplands to meet food demand in the United States. So how did you, as a professor of environmental engineering, come to decide to study metropolitan farmland?
Right. Well, you know, it was sort of by accident, which is how a lot of great studies really happen.
Serendipity.
Exactly. Yeah, I've done a lot of work on really large scale kind of global processes, trying to understand global climate change. And one of the things you need in these models of the global atmosphere is to know what's happening down on the land. What are the people doing? So I've done a lot of work to help advance making new maps of what the agriculture system is doing. Where are the croplands? How are they changing? And it occurred to me that, you know, there's a lot of other interesting questions besides global climate change we could go after using these new maps we've made, and local food was one of them.
Well, quick question. It always seems to me like the best cities grow up on the best farmland. Is that something you recognize when you're constructing your maps?
The best cities grow up on the best farmlands. You know, that's an interesting observation. I hadn't thought of that. In the case of our study, we were looking at how many people you could feed around each city. Mm-hmm. And it would be a function of things like how much land is available, what the quality of the land is, so how much yield you could get per acre. But the best city, that's it. You know, there's so many layers, really, you could add to this analysis. We've really laid a foundation here by seeing sort of what the geophysical potential, that's what we call it. Just based on the quality of the land, how many people there are, where the people are, where the land is, how many could you feed. But there's all these other interesting layers that people are now trying to slap onto
this
analysis.
Maybe I tossed you an interesting layer there. I don't know. It just seems to me like, you know, way back when, before there were cities, you know, people would trudge out into the wilderness and look around for a good place that had the capability of feeding them. And so, you know, that's where they parked their butts. And as, you know, more people came and more people started feeding themselves, you know, agriculture grew and supported the city, and the city grew and pretty soon ate up all the farmland. And there you are. But that seems to be, you know, there are exceptions, of course, like Los Angeles, and you know, and but there are places, and I'm sure that's going to be something that pops up as we go along here, because as our engineer and our producer said, how is it possible that some cities can feed themselves, you know, but 90%, that's extraordinary.
It really is.
So what exactly was the accident? Was it actually an accident that you came to study this?
Sort of. You know, I've always been interested in local food. Farmers markets and CSAs has always been a part of how we get our food in our household. And I certainly was exposed to some of, you know, the broader thoughts about this topic from even local departments. Like here at UC Santa Cruz, the Environmental Studies Department has done a lot of work on what the possible importance or even unintended consequences of local food would be. But what I'd never seen is a study that just said, well, how much could we do? It seems like that's kind of a first thing you want to do with anything, just see how big would this scale. If you're going to hem and haw forever about some new idea and it has no potential to go big, then why put all this thought into it? So I thought it was time that maybe we should do that.
Well, let me ask you, because when I first came out with my book Metro Farm many years ago, you know, it was people looked at me and said, you're crazy, you're a heretic, you can't do this. And I came to realize that metropolitan agriculture or local food is a distinct threat to industrial agriculture that operates on very thin margins on very high volumes of products. And so when the book came out, you know, people threw rocks at me. And I'm wondering about you, because, you know, you're putting something on the table here that does pose a threat to industrial agriculture in just stating the fact that it's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's possible at a massive scale, at least from this geophysical potential. 90% of the U.S. being fed by local food would really turn the tables. So yeah, there's definitely probably some.
Well, did people throw rocks at you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's plenty of stories in the media about this study, mm-hmm. and plenty of critiques about it. But, you know, right now, I think an important thing to always remember is that local food is growing explosively. It's surging. Food hubs, CSAs, farmers markets have sort of leveled off in size, but the growth is still massive. It's predicted to hit $20 billion maybe in the next 5 years, $20 billion in sales per year. So that's massive. But that's still sort of a drop in the bucket. It's a few percent of the total food budget for the U.S.
But so. It is a significant small percentage.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, folks, here we go. We're going to have some fun today. We're going to talk about the potential, the large potential of local croplands to meet food demand in the United States. Can 90% of us who live in cities be fed from the food that grows in and around cities? And how is that possible? That's the question we have on the table today with Dr. Elliot Campbell, professor of environmental engineering, UC Merced, and his entire family right here in the studios. Do stay tuned, right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. Is it true 90% of us that live in cities across the entire United States could be fed on food grown within 100 miles of the city that we live in? You know, we've all heard about the 100-mile diet. Wow, is it really possible? Well, Dr. Elliot Campbell did an academic of UC Merced Environmental Engineering, looked at the subject, and that's what he concluded. Mike, how did you start with that, doctor? What do you look at? How do you begin a study of this sort?
Right. Well, there's a couple ingredients. One is having maps of where the farmlands are, and that was really our core contribution. We'd been working on this for a long time.
So this is something you've been working on.
Right. Anyway. Yeah, national maps of farmland going back in time, going back, mm-hmm. say, 150 years in time.
That would be interesting. Is that available?
Yeah, it's on our website. Anyone can download it.
Where's the website?
It's faculty.ucmerced.edu/ecampbell3, the number three.
Okay, so there you go.
So anyhow, we put all our data online. And then once you have that piece of information, you sort of have a rough sense of the proximity of the croplands to the cities. Another ingredient you need to know is how many people are in the cities, how hungry those people are, and then how much food you can produce per acre of land. So those are kind of the pieces that come together in, mm-hmm. this study.
Who funded the study? I always ask, this is my favorite question, you know, of any guest. Where does the money come from?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. Janet Napolitano is the president of the whole UC system.
UC system, yeah.
Yeah, and
she's a foodie.
She is, exactly. She's brought a lot of food-related research energy to, mm-hmm. the UC. So people like me, who hadn't been working on food, took a look at this new initiative she was doing and said, oh, you know, maybe we could apply some of our work to Janet's program. It's called the Global Food Initiative.
Global Food Initiative, yeah, exactly. And I was there when she introduced it with Alice Waters, yeah. And so I said, what the heck is that? And she said, well, give us a little while to get it squared away, you know. Give us a little while to figure it out. So you're part of the figuring out then.
Absolutely.
Good. And this study, you've been working on maps of farmlands throughout the United States and the world?
Yeah, right now we've really focused on the United States. Earlier this decade, we are looking at a global scale. And we were really thinking about this input to these global climate change models, because when you change the agricultural land, you change what happens in the climate. The land is exchanging energy and water and chemicals with the atmosphere, so it's really an important feature in understanding global climate change. But of course, it's really an important feature in understanding food production.
Kind of hard to think of farmland as a living, breathing entity, isn't it? I mean, it's easy to think of it as something that's really not living, but it is living.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So, and you're looking at this, and at what point did you decide that we could actually be fed? I mean, where did you come up with that notion that 90% of us could be fed?
Yeah. Well, we put those ingredients together, where the cropland is, how productive it is, where the people are, how hungry they are. And then we used an optimization algorithm to allocate.
Oh, algorithm. They're the magic, right?
Okay. Right, exactly. To search through, you know, each little piece of land and allocate it to a city. Mm-hmm. And we did that over and over and over again until we could feed the most people in the U.S. So we did this most efficiently, and we constrained what city each little piece of land could feed with these different radiuses. We said, okay, well, we're going to do a scenario where you only can feed people that are within 100 miles of your farmland, or 50 miles. We did a number of different scenarios. But with the 100-mile scenario, allocating each unit of land to only one city, we came up with 90% of all the food that everyone needs in the country for a year being possibly fed by the farms within 100 miles.
Let's back up for a minute, and I'd like to ask, what the heck is an algorithm? And how does it go about measuring the potential of land?
Right. So in this case, this search algorithm had to make sure that each city got...
First of all, what is an algorithm?
An algorithm is a computer program.
So that it just measures pluses or minuses or zeros or ones, and that's it, right?
Yeah, more or less. And in this case, it searches through the space of all possible combinations of giving croplands to different cities and finds if we give it to a certain city versus a different city, how many people can be fed. So it sort of iteratively goes over and over again through this search. And then,
so does it measure the difference? Does it take into consideration the difference between a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania and a Los Angeles, California?
Absolutely. So the model needs to know how many people are in the city, and it has to know the per capita food requirement, and it has to know the land.
Is that different? I mean, is the per capita food requirement different from city to city?
It absolutely is. This case, though, in this study, we began with sort of a national average. Okay. Everyone's eating about the same amount of food per year. Although we did do different scenarios. So we did a scenario where everyone was vegetarian or vegan, or everyone was eating a very meat-intensive diet. Future work, it would be really interesting, and I think this is what you're pointing to go in and say, well, you know, this city's eating a little higher on the food chain, this one a little lower. Maybe there's some differences to tease out there.
Mm-hmm. I would suspect, and this is just a personal theory I've always had, that those who live in higher latitudes would be eating higher on the food chain than those who live in lower latitudes. But that's just my way of thinking, because it's really difficult to live on rutabaga sandwiches if you're living in the North Pole. You need you need a lot of fat. You need a lot of protein. But that's just my theory. So you do have an algorithm, measures the difference between each city. Each city is, what about the environment?
Yeah, the environment. How does the environment tie into this? Well, one way it ties in is it tells you how productive your land will be. How productive the land is going to be partially a function of the temperature, the rain, these types of things.
Is that part of an algorithm then?
It is.
Really?
Yeah, and it's kind of tough to do. This is kind of
It gets pretty complicated in here.
It sure does, because we don't have empirical evidence everywhere. I mean, we can't go through around each city and say, okay, well, we know – you know, this is how much broccoli you could get per acre of land if you grew it here. This is how much of this strawberries and, every other crop variety. So there's some assumptions that you have to make.
You know, for that's a good one we could pick up right now. So here in California's Central Coast, we have an environment with X amount of rainfall and so on and so on. And you could compare that with, for example, Virginia, which is on the other side of the country, which has X amount of rainfall. But there's a difference here because we have that coastal fog that moderates climate so that one can grow strawberries for like 9 months a year, whereas in Virginia, you could only grow it 2 or 3 months a year.
Yeah, so these smaller climate features, not just these broad-scale features, but, yeah, the fog is playing a really interesting role in crop productivity here. And Michael Loik, someone at UC Santa Cruz, is actually really delving into this in more detail. So we have people working on that. In this case, for this study, you know, we really didn't – you know, if you want to do the whole country and you've got all these other kind of issues to deal with, where the people are, where the croplands are, in this case, we had to use more of a broad-brushed approach.
Sure, sure. Because when you're measuring every place – you have to use a broad brush, yeah.
Exactly. And so ultimately, this will lead to other studies that kind of focus in on, say, case studies maybe of Monterey County and look at the fog and look at its effect on productivity. But in our case, we used a couple indicator crops as indicators of how productive the land
was. What were the indicator crops?
So we used corn and hay.
Okay.
And when those were...
So forage crops.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right.
And so then we have these two crops, and what can we do with these two crops as indicators of potential throughout the entire country? And that's the subject of the table today. How can we feed the entire 90% of the population of our cities with land grown in and around those cities, within 100 miles? That's close. Is it possible? You think of cities like Los Angeles? Could Los Angeles feed itself with land within 100 miles? Well, if you think about it, there's a lot of farmland within 100 miles of Los Angeles. What about New York City? Well, same there, too. We do stay tuned. 831-479-1080. Right back. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. And I'm Michael Olson. Today we're talking about local food with Dr. Elliot Campbell. UC Merced, professor of environmental engineering. What the heck is environmental engineering?
Yeah, environmental engineers take ideas from engineering, from science, and use that to understand pollution and the efficient use of resources. So this comes into play for understanding climate change, air quality in cities, wastewater treatment, those kinds of things.
And so you made the transition from environmental engineering to agriculture, which is really not a transition at all, because that's the essential core mission of agriculture is environmental engineering, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the efficient use of resources in agriculture is a critical issue. It's a huge consumer of water, as we all know. But what one thing is that might surprise people is that it's a huge source of greenhouse gases. I mean, certainly our power plants and cars are, but agriculture, by some estimates, is 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It's massive.
Where does that come from?
You know, it comes from a lot of things. Agriculture is pretty diverse, but some big players are cows, methane sources, rice also methane sources, and fertilizing the land, which is kind of has a double whammy. One, you burn methane to produce the fertilizer in the fertilizer factory, and two, a gas called nitrous oxide off-gases from the fields, and it's a very potent greenhouse gas.
Exhales. Yes. There's the land exhaling again, right?
Absolutely.
Well, let's go back quickly to the notion of using corn and hay as measurements of land production. Now, when you took these measurements, how did you measure them? Did you measure them from, you know, the industrial models of production? You take that per acre and use that as your model then?
Right. So in our model, we needed information that existed everywhere in the country because we're trying to do the whole country.
Right.
And the USDA publishes annual data on crop productivity at a county level. And one thing that we found that existed across most of the country was hay and corn. Mm-hmm. And so we could use that as an indicator of how productive the land is. Now, some people might say, well, hay and corn, that has nothing to do with broccoli and strawberries or all the
but
more diverse diet.
But it's an indicator. It's just, if we can do this, this is the average, you know, then what we can do, yeah.
Exactly. We thought it might be an indicator. And then we compared our approach to sort of a case study in the Midwest where they did have actual measurements of a wide variety of crops, not just corn and hay. And our number came out really similar to their number for the Midwest. So we felt that with some confidence, we could use these as indicators for the whole U.S.
So you're ballparking then?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, as we were talking about in the break, some of the best discussions, of course, happen in the breaks when they're not supposed to, but that's where they do happen. I made mention of the fact that when we look at these studies, we tend to use the production values of industrial agriculture. And I put forward the argument that there are agricultures throughout the world that have relied on space-intensive production technologies that have nothing to do with the way we do things. And probably the most interesting example of that was when the Secretary of Agriculture, F.H. King, went to China in the turn of at the year 1900 to teach the Chinese modern production technologies. And when he got there, it took him about 3 seconds to realize that the production technologies we use here with all of our space have nothing to do with the production technologies of China, which lives on farmers with 2 acres or a half acre or whatnot. And so when he looked at them, he realized that their productivity was so much greater. I think an acre of cucumbers in China would produce 8 times more cucumbers than the industrial agriculture that we are using. And so I'm tossing this to you, Dr. Campbell. When you look at the production of the productive potential of all that farmland that surrounds cities around the country, isn't that a consideration that should be put into notion, the fact that we could actually use space-intensive production technologies to get a whole bunch more out of that land?
Yeah, I think that's an exciting area to pursue. One thing I see just from these
I think I'm still ahead of the eight ball on that. My wife accuses me of always being 25 years too far ahead, so I'm worthless. But maybe that's still in the future then, or still something we're looking at.
I think it's something we should go after. In general, it's actually sort of the flip of what you are talking about is what we see when you look at global maps of productivity. The U.S. can be sort of a hot spot for productivity. Europe, too, because of all the inputs, mm-hmm. Water, fertilizers.
And the land.
And good land.
And land.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And climate, all those things.
Everything is perfect here for production.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think what you're talking about is at a finer scale, you might zoom into a specific location mm-hmm. in China and see, wow, they're really, really just doing great things here. And maybe experimenting with more diverse approaches. I know aquaculture is sort of a thing mm-hmm. that's happening right around here now that claims to have huge productivities per unit area of land.
Right, right.
Those are all things that could be looked into. One thing that I will say for sure that'll change the yields of land in a major way in the West is water, right? Water. Where you have water, you grow crops. So one of the things you could do for a next step in our study is to go back and say, well, you didn't have water allocated to this land. If you did change the status quo and brought water here, maybe this city could all of a sudden feed a lot more. And that's a very contentious issue out here. But one way to get around that, I think, is to begin to consider treated wastewater as a source of providing irrigation for croplands around mm-hmm. cities.
Yeah, getting more water. Well, let's have a little fun. We'll go to the phones. Today, the phone number is 831-479-1080. What do you think out there? Do you think the notion that cities could feed themselves within 100 miles is completely crazy? Or do you agree with Dr. Elliot Campbell here that, by golly, we can do it? Let's go to the phones, and we'll talk with Mark. Mark, welcome to the food chain.
Hi, gentlemen. Wouldn't you find that limiting
Wait a minute. What makes you think we're gentlemen?
Oh, well, I'm making that assumption.
Okay.
Limiting agriculture within 100 miles of a city would also limit your the variety within your diet. You know, this morning I had coffee, I had bananas. They're not going to grow within 100 miles of where I live. The other thing, here in California where I farm, land right now is selling for $60,000 an acre. So you're going to grow a specially high-value crop on that acre. You're not going to grow corn or wheat. And you know, environmentally, it would make no sense to grow corn or wheat on that either, because in Nebraska, you can dry farm it. We're out here, I'd have to irrigate that corn or wheat. So, again, the inputs would be increased for a field crop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the reality is that we grow what we can sell, and we grow what's economically feasible on the high-valued land that we farm on. And doing soybeans out here would not make any sense, and growing artichokes in Minnesota would not make any sense. And also, today in Vermont, like in Burlington, Vermont, I'd hate to eat a diet that was limited to 100 miles from my city because it's all frozen.
Mark, you have so many great objections. Can you hold through this break so we can pick them up?
Sure.
All right, great. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Dr. Elliot Campbell, can we feed ourselves with food that grows within 100 miles of the city? Mark has a whole bunch of great objections, and we're going to address them when we come back. You can object, too, at 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. Right back. Welcome back. Food Chain Radio Program. Can we feed ourselves 90% maybe up with the food that grows around our city? Dr. Elliot Campbell says it's a possibility. Right now it's only like 1%, but Dr. Campbell says it can be much greater. Mark says, wait a minute, hold the phone. I have some objections. Mark, let's start with objection number one.
Well, again, I had coffee and bananas for breakfast this morning. We don't even grow those in the United States. So they're not going to come within 100 miles of my city. So
that would be
eliminated from my diet if we followed this protocol here.
Let's pick that up. Variety being the spice of life, will we no longer have variety, Dr. Campbell?
Oh, right. So, Mark, I think that's a really great point, and that's one of the first issues that often is raised when people see these results. You know, we're not arguing that all your food should come from local food, but we are trying to make the argument that right now, local food is a niche of a niche. It's the tiniest contribution to most people's food in the U.S., could it be bigger? Could it be a significant chunk? And our results show that it could be. So you could still have your coffee, your bananas, but maybe 10%, I don't know, 20% of your diet could come from food locally. It's possible.
Well, again, here growing in California, we compete against what we call the homegrown, the local produce in the summer on the East Coast, Midwest, and even Canada. But we offer consistency. We offer consistency in quality, and we offer the big thing is consistency in supply. And right now, you know, Burlington, Vermont, their local homegrown is very limited, unless you like maple syrup, I would suppose. But, I think both.
Well, can we pick that one up, Mark?
Producers have a market to supply, and, you know, we do it through our own expertise, our own opportunities, and what we do well.
That's a great objection. Now, that's what I thought. You know, 90% throughout the United States, I mean, Los Angeles, Burlington, Vermont, how are these cities going to feed themselves, Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, okay, so having 20% of your diet being maple syrup is nothing anyone other than my two kids who were here just a minute ago would enjoy, right? And so, again, going back to our study, it's the theoretical potential. So we looked at where the croplands were, how productive they are, and where the people are. And we imagine that if you grew more diverse crops, how many people could you feed? And so we're not really concerned with what's growing right now. We're really concerned with the quality of the land, the environment, how many people they are, and how much food they need. And so what our study does is envisions a future where local food is more than this tiny, less than a percent of our food consumption? Is it possible? So again, it's not about what crops are being grown where right now, but if we wanted to do local food, could we? And the answer is yes.
You know, I think about my grandparents in Belfry, Montana, who lived on a farm and had very, very little money to spend on city food, which is to say going into town and buying food that comes in packages. And there just wasn't that. But their diet was incredibly rich with all kinds of things. In winter, it was preserved. But it was still seemed to be wonderful, wonderfully diverse. But there was no fresh strawberries.
The other example of the efficiency of small farms in China, I gave a tour to several agronomists from China, and we're discussing how we farm here, and I brought up the concept of herbicides, and one farmer stated, I do not use herbicides. And I said, well, why not? He said, because I can hire a man for $200 a year to come and weed my crops. And, you know, that's fine, except I would not want to be that man earning $200 a year, even in China. That'd be a pretty poor existence.
That's a great point. What about labor? What about, and you're absolutely right with respect to my notion of metropolitan agriculture. It is labor intensive. It does require the labor and ingenuity above all else of the human being. You gotta have somebody that's really smart to be able to do the agriculture, to be a farmer. And you know how much intelligence it takes to be a farmer, Mark, because you are one.
No, if I was smart, I'd be doing something else.
Right. You would be sitting in front of a computer, answering the phone and taking coffee breaks, right?
Another thing is people don't want to live next to farms. The concept of having a farm near the city, near where the people live. And believe me, they do not like the
smell. Have you heard of agri-hoods?
No.
People are, I just wrote a piece on this recently. People are beginning, real estate developers are beginning to develop housing neighborhoods around working farms in the same way they used to develop them around golf courses.
Well,
and people
I
are buying the houses.
I think the reality is people do not like living next to working farms. I mean, they like looking at them and such, but the complaints that come through are numerous and frequent. But again, you know, interesting concept.
Yeah. You know, getting back to your labor comment just for a second, I wouldn't want to be that person weeding that field either. But if I was a farm laborer, I would like the idea of not having to move my family seasonally. And if a farm is producing food year-round because it's trying to feed people that are adjacent to it, I might be able to have a little bit more of a stationary lifestyle. And I've visited farms where this happens. So Tom and Dinesh Wiley have a farm over in Madera that does exactly that. So, you know, it's a complicated issue, but there may be some benefits for labor.
And we'll pick that up when we come back. The big question, of course, what the heck does all this mean for the future of how we feed ourselves? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, 831-479-1980. Dr. Elliot Campbell, UC Merced, Professor of Environmental Engineering. Right back. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. A few minutes left with Dr. Elliot Campbell, Professor of Environmental Engineering, UC Merced, California's Great Central Valley, and probably one of the most productive valleys in the entire world in terms of agricultural productivity. So when you look at Sacramento, duck soup, right? For feeding the city of Sacramento, 100 miles in each direction, you have some of the most productive farmland in the world, so that's easy. But what about like Milwaukee or Chicago or Green Bay, Wisconsin, someplace where it's terribly, miserably cold right now?
Right. Yeah. So climate's a huge issue and the growing season could be really limited. But you could imagine that at least these cities, instead of having less than a percent of their food coming from local food, if they did have a big growing season effort to make local food, then maybe it could be 5 or 10%. And the other neat thing about these cities is even though Their climate might be poor. They're resource intensive. The thing about agriculture is it uses water, it uses nutrients, it uses all these things. We'd like to not get them from the environment or from fossil fuels. We'd like to find ways to sort of recycle these energy and water resources. And the cities are a source of water. They're a source of nutrients. If you could put a farm close to a city, you could really start to close some of these really dangerous environmental impacts of agriculture.
You know, whenever I bring the notion up, as I have for the last 20 years, people say, Olson, you can't feed people from small parcels of land close to the city. How do you address that?
You could feed some people some of the time. That's what we want to do here. People want it, and the earth needs it. There's
right
a lot
now, it's less than 1%?
Right, exactly.
The potential is?
Well, we're showing 90% for the U.S., and you'll whittle that away as you add more layers to this analysis, but at least it shows that there's a there. This isn't doomed to always be the niche of niche markets that it is today. It could grow to something substantial if we think about it and want to move it that way.
What would happen to the industrial agriculture if we do?
Well, I think it will always exist. It's really hard to imagine, corn for feed being grown on these local farms. And as Mark said, that's something you'd want to do in rain-fed areas and not in these high-value farms that he's working at in California. So the two will always simultaneously exist. But local food, if it's grown and if it's done in an appropriate way, it could start to provide a significant chunk of the food we need and do it in a way that doesn't harm the environment.
That it can be done is one thing. Will it allowed to be done is another.
That's right. Well, there's obviously a surge right now. There's exponential growth. Like I said, it's predicted to hit $20 billion in the next 5 years. There's some farm bill support. And then there's this huge movement of people that are excited about it. So it does seem like I have an optimistic outlook, at least.
There it is. Okay. And it would be nice if we were able to feed ourselves. That would be very optimistic. And if we can do that. And if we can't do that, we're going to all be in very deep trouble. Well, Dr. Ellie Campbell, thanks for so much for joining us today on the 1046th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. And I think, folks, we're going to file this program under Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, which is the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food. And if we're growing 90% of what we eat pretty close to home, we're going to have a lot of control. Thanks again. If you have any thoughts, tune in at metrofarm.com. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.